I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, naked in a queer bookstore window here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kennedy Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
Back with us, our favorites, our actual favorites. It's not actually Barrett Doss, like we said last week. It's actually Brooke Solomon, Jordan Gustafson of the Queer Quadrant Podcast. So happy to have you guys back.
We're back, baby. It's a delight to be back. Listen,
this is
you smell that? It's the smell episode. Of books.
It smells like books.
Episode. It smells like books in here.
I was gonna
that
say
is my.
At least you know if you watch a movie that includes women naked in a bookstore window, you know who to call. Mm. Like you have someone
That's
in
right.
his phone book who you can look up.
This was the thing where like. I was looking at the list of movies we had left to cover, and I was like, we gotta have them on for Better Than Chocolate. If I mean, it's like this is, it's kind of crazy that we have recorded a 99 episode with you already, which will come out probably sometime
eventually
in the next couple months.
You never know.
It will. It will come out.
Oh, and it certainly will come out.
It's too hot. I don't know if the airwaves
can handle it. Yeah, it's Crazy in Alabama, everyone's favorite Melanie Griffith movie.
Everyone remembers that.
Everyone remembers that film.
Tell me to recall a plot point from that movie. I don't know if I could.
I'm trying to remember
there
one.
I remember. Didn't Melanie Griffith solve racism or something?
There's a head
she
in
did.
A box.
She did.
Yeah,
she also she like flirts her way into getting someone out of prison, out of a jail cell, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. In fact, I think.
Yeah, so we don't remember this well, but like,
but it doesn't matter. The point is, this movie actually makes sense to have you guys on for.
The thing about any movie makes sense for you guys to have on, for Christ's sakes. The thing about this movie versus Crazy in Alabama is like, we can fuck around with Crazy in Alabama, say whatever you want, but like, people will get on our ass if we don't get Better Than Chocolate perfect by the minute, beat by beat.
The rabid fan base of Better Than
Chocolate. What can we say about Better Than Chocolate that hasn't already been said?
I have a few questions, actually.
Okay.
Are there things that are better than chocolate? And I don't know. This movie presupposes that this movie might be better than chocolate. And I don't think it is.
The song, Ice Cream by Sarah McLachlan, she lists the things that are better than chocolate. Most importantly, Your Love is better than chocolate. So it
seemed like it was orgasms. I think that's just what, was what the book
that's what the mom was getting at, right? If,
yes.
If you remember the hit film from 2003, Down with Love, there's a similar using chocolate to replace the pleasures of sex subplot.
Good movie.
And
I mean, this is 1999, this film was made in Canada. Yeah, Sarah McLachlan was going to feature prominently in this. Like this was going to be a part of it. I, you know, I, as our listeners know, I'm from Canada. I don't really remember this movie. I have a vague recollection of it existing.
You've been kind of, it's been on our radar for a very long time. It has been
for a while. Because, and you know, Brooke and Jordan and I discussed a little bit a few nights ago of this movie, just very cursory kind of thing. And I do
were you guys just like hanging out without me?
We were just hanging out. Yeah, just hanging out.
Fuck?
We were thinking about,
we were thinking
about recording an episode.
And, you guys are just just doing Zoom hangouts? What are we doing tonight? We're gonna play a little Zoom Parcheesi.
Yeah,
but I bring this up.
Children, sorry.
I bring this up because I feel like this movie now, through a 2022 lens, obviously this film isn't
dated.
It's dated. It's very dated.
It could be more dated.
But it could be more dated, and it's, you gotta give them some credit for doing this in 1999.
Yes.
Like, I hit play on this movie. And I was like, okay, so this is some fucking Canadian 90s shit right here.
Oh, boy.
And, but I was like, they kind of throw you in the deep end. They kind of are just like, they kind of take for granted the fact that people are going to be fine with this subject matter, which I think is fantastic to be that, I hate to say it, but courageous at the time. It took some courage to do that. I now look at the film and think to myself, it might be more courageous than some of the movies that are made today. Like, I just, which I think is sad.
I basically don't have any qualms with this movie and how it was made in like 1999 with kind of like all of the, you know, given like where culture was at the time. I think that, yes, of course, if you look at it from like a 20 years in the future type lens, you can definitely find plenty of things to be like, well, but I don't know. I think that like that is the best, maybe the only way to watch queer cinema, especially like underseen indie queer cinema that was kind of like grappling with a lot of being like, there's not a lot of this in the marketplace. We don't really know, like there's nothing really to base it off of aside from like the other sort of messy indie queer cinema that's come before. So I think that like, that's the best way to watch these kinds of movies is not to get too hung up in the like, oh, well, if it was happening today, but I totally agree with you and that there is like kind of, you know, there's definitely some heavy topics in this. It does throw you like into the deep end. And I think it like, it handles tone in a way that I don't see a queer movie. It's certainly a mainstream queer movie handling tone today. And that like, there's very serious stuff juxtaposed with like extremely lighthearted stuff without a ton of like taking you gently from one to the other.
Oh yeah. Whiplash, just total whiplash going on. I think it's like, also interesting.
Quaint bookstore, hate crime.
Yeah, exactly. And then back.
Well, like, I think it's funny that Kenny and I, we recorded another episode today. We recorded an episode on A Single Man, the 2009 film for our Patreon. And I think it's interesting for us to be covering two overtly queer movies, both coming at it from drastically dissimilar vantage points, right? I don't even mean just subject matter wise. I mean, this film is so far from a Tom Ford picture. Like, this is, you know what I mean? Like, this movie is low budget. It's, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not. But at the same time, I think they're both incredibly bold movies in their own way at the time that they came out.
I think there's a very like interesting gender element to that comparison too, because like the Tom Ford, A Single Man is very like classic like arch gay cinema, and this is very like indie lesbian cinema, and they're two like
micro budget
separate things. Especially because I feel like when you get highbrow arch lesbian cinema, it's almost always made by men, and is just a lot more like stilted and structured than like this, which is like we're fucking in the shower. Like you really don't. It's not. It's not nearly as common.
The highbrow arch lesbian cinema we're talking about is like the Carols of the world, right?
Yeah.
But, I
mean, perfect movie, should we
Incredible
say?
Oh,
Carol's the best. Oh, yeah. But I, but not I also think Carol. It's like, there's something interesting about how this sort of dreamlike tone poem of a single man, right? But then you'll also have like two lesbians painting each other in like the most high school drama kind of way that also feels kind of weird, you know, dreamlike.
This is like
queers really, really have multitudes. I never, I didn't see it before this. I didn't see it. I thought every queer movie was the exact same, but you could have all these crazy things over here and crazy things over there.
I am seeking someone to take me on a first date where we paint each other's bodies and roll around on canvas, and then it gets hung on the wall of our shared apartment.
That's very, very secure of you. The last thing I want is for anyone to be putting paint on my body.
This is an A plus U-hauling movie, and I think
It is. It's a big U-Haul film.
They passed
the U-Haul. They already took the U-Haul. They're moving. They like skipped the middle steps.
It's advanced U-Hauling because when they get in the car to U-Haul, it's literally already
it already
home.
Happened.
She already lives in.
We moved
the
in
van.
Together already.
Well, you could ask me the question that I want to ask you.
This is our second bookstore rom com, I believe, of 99.
The
love letter being the other one, I think.
The love letter. Is it really only our second? It's a genre unto itself.
It feels like
We definitely did the love letter where they hang out at the bookstore a lot. I'll think about it a little more. Here's what I want. I wanted to ask you a little more substantive question. Substantive. So, Phil, you grew up in Canada. You pretty much lived in Canada your whole life until you moved here.
25 years,
talk to me a little bit about the difference between queer culture in Canada and America and homophobia in Canada and America. What was different for you? Because I think a lot of what you were saying in the beginning in terms of how bold it is, a matter of fact it is, and all those things has to be viewed through this, like, it's a different culture lens. I mean, it's not completely different, but you know, because when I was going to make some joke about how 1999 Canada is like 1991 America, because that's how kind of how it
There's
looks, you know?
Yeah.
Like in terms of just where they were kind of, I don't know, visually, right? And we've seen a bunch of Canadian films, which I love, but just, you know, fucking my favorite movie last night shot on like, you know,
home
VHS.
Video, basically.
So, and that's like, I think that was all that they can get across the border in those days. So,
oh my God.
But so technologically you're in 91, culturally you're a lot closer to today.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I guess that the short answer to your question is that I didn't even think about it. And I think that that speaks volumes, right? Like it never was something that, gay people, sure. Like it was not, I was never surrounded. I mean, I think that Canada prides itself on, one of the big things is, you know, we're not a melting pot, we're multicultural. I think that the country prides itself on being the whole spectrum of people, right? And I think that this country, and I believes in assimilation, right? Like, I think that there is very much a,
we always have,
right? And I think that that distinction, obviously, you can be felt in the gay world as well. I think that I just watching this film, I did find myself, it was pretty heartwarming, not just on a subject matter level, but just there's something quaint ultimately about how kind of nimble and sort of wide-eyed and positive and progressive a lot of the films are that come out of Canada. You know, you just don't see that as much down here.
There was still clearly, you answered the question flawlessly. That was important context. There's still obviously a lot of internalized trauma. Because so much of this film comes from this place of I'm traumatized because of my relationship with my parents. I'm traumatized because of the way people look at me. I'm traumatized, with the, the trans character. I'm traumatized because of the way I've been treated in women's spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's interesting. It's an interesting thing because I do think that this film exists because I think Canada is a multicultural, accepting place. And also, queer identity is such that you never quite feel like you're not being, excluded. I think.
I think that
universal. Yeah.
I also think that ultimately with any subculture, and I don't mean to suggest that being queer is a subculture necessarily, but just to be a minority of any sort, right?
Just just means like lesser. That's all.
I think it low key is a subculture, though. Like
I didn't mean for it to sound derogatory.
If you engage with it in like a way that you choose to engage with like any sort of subculture, I think like it definitely fits into that bucket.
Sure, I think it's interesting because I feel like any sort of thing that could potentially alienate you or potentially make you an outsider or whatever the case might be, if you have the courage to wrap your arms around it and be like, this is me, I don't fucking care what the ramifications are or the fallout is for this or if there are consequences for these actions, I think that that there's going to be trauma that comes with that in some form or another. Hopefully it's not something violent or terrible, but I just feel like so this is going to sound weird, but just bear with me for a second. It does make sense. I'm watching an episode of For All Mankind last night. And this really isn't a spoiler, but there's one of the astronauts, they land on fucking Mars and he's doing a video interview and he says that he's gay and it's an alternate American history. Yeah. So we're in the mid 90s at this point, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell doesn't exist because Bill Clinton never got elected. And there's just all of these sort of, so there's this kind of moment where the country is grappling with homosexuality in a way that it doesn't really know how to sort of articulate and how to really deal with it, especially the Republican Party. This is all just a way of saying that I feel like, there's a black astronaut that turns to this gay male astronaut and says, you have the luxury of being able to hide your thing. And he's like, luxury. Like, I just think that there's something about the fact that this film, that these characters are fearless in their love, fearless in their romantic optimism and in the way that they see the world. And that's just really lovely to watch. It's basically the exact opposite of what we talked about earlier today, Kenny, in terms of someone feeling just the oppression of 1960s homophobia and just a complete lack of being able to be themselves. Yeah. And unfortunately, it feels like, outside of the aforementioned Bruno, when we talked about that movie, I do feel like you don't see as much. I mean, listen, I hope the Bros is great. It looks really funny. I hope it's great. I think that you obviously can make films that are more joyous about the queer experience, but I think that there's so much trauma down here, so much more trauma down here than in Canada, that it's just, that's why I think a lot of it is about grappling with that.
And go for it. Okay. All right. So feel free to jump in. So I think that trauma is an interesting word because I agree with you on the idea that like if you're out about the fact that you're queer, there's probably going to be a sense of othering from someone at some point that you like can't avoid and that usually does have some sort of like negative repercussions. Like you said, the severity of it can like really, really vary. But I think that like, especially in American cinema, but not exclusively, the idea of like the queer films usually have to be trauma focused is really like due to what we talk about on our show all the time is like this sense of box office where it's like,
sure,
you get the idea that people are not going to be as willing to show up for a queer movie that doesn't have some sort of heavy social message attached to it. The, you know, in the way that like they don't show up for a lot of like marginalized joyous stories, which is obviously not the case. And I feel like that's really like that theory has really started to be debunked. Like, but I don't know. So a lot of these like really joyous queer stories, I think, tend to stick to the really, really indie spaces. Yeah. And or TV. Like TV has always been like a couple steps ahead of mm-hmm. like commercial film in terms of letting queer characters like be happy.
Well, it's sort of like when we talked about Crazy in Alabama, we talked a little bit about Almodovar, and we talked yeah. about how his films are, I mean, his films have a whole spectrum, yeah. but he's, they're larger than life. The punch of these colors, the all just feels very sort of like up. You don't see a ton of that here. You know what I mean? We obviously talked about Moulin Rouge and it being what it is. But again, we don't get that many of those. I mean, it's right. unfortunate.
I mean, just look at like Fire Island, which I feel like is a good example for talking example. About like things that are like blatantly queer while also like having a good story, like an actual story to it, and like not about just being queer and that like the trauma that comes with that. I feel like sort of with this movie, I guess like my bumps and frustrations with it, not frustrations, but like, I guess, yeah, frustrations are like, one, I think that there's not really a plot. And I think that what we're talking about with this like joyful, like queerness is definitely there and that carries so much of it forward, but it's so not like meandering, but like meandering, you know? And like, it's really hard to sort of like get in sync with it because it just sort of like feels a little bit monotonous at times. And at the same time, I think that it's really cool how they treat Judy, the trans character, and how like accepting they are of her.
Totally.
But at the same time, then there's like so much baggage that then comes on the opposite side of that, where like so much of their trans identity and like the conversations come from like the idea of like genitalia and like surgery and everything, which is like not necessarily so much about like the trans experience, obviously. And so like it's that sort of
thing. But I respect that they like even ventured into the water.
No, for sure.
It's also in 99. Very 1990s.
That's the thing, is it's just like
be that's like it's so crazy. Like the more I feel like we talked about this probably on the Bruno episode, honestly. about like the different subsections of like the queer community and how like sometimes everyone is in sync and sometimes everyone is kind of like fighting with each other, and what is considered kind of like progressive at the time changes so rapidly. Like I feel like there was a big sort of like push in the 90s to be like, we're recognizing trans people by being like, yes, it is kind of about your genitalia, but only because like we want to get people more comfortable with that and like get it more into the mainstream. And I feel like that has really changed now.
You also like, have like Priscilla Queen of the Desert or something along those lines. Like I think that America and maybe even the world at large really had trouble distinguishing or grappling with
still
drag queens.
Oh
trans.
God, yeah.
Like,
oh
it's,
yeah.
It's, yeah. It's this a very,
is,
yeah.
This is the same year as Boys Don't Cry, which is like,
it is.
I think a very, very different portrayal of like,
oh, yeah.
how we should be seeing trans people on screen. Like it's exactly
and
what
And a much better
about.
Movie on a myriad of levels.
Yeah. But traumatic, yeah. like but so trauma focused.
Literally based on
yeah.
trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boys it's, Do Cry. Yeah.
Well, they do.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, go ahead, Kenny.
I think the conversation about trauma obviously is interesting and probably a little traumatic, to be honest. I've seen it. I've seen it. You know, not with. I've never worked on a gay focused show, but I've worked on several shows that were black focused. And so many of the black writers just push so hard against stories about black pain and black misery, yeah. black trauma. And you can feel the trauma of the experience of watching, you know, portrayal after portrayal after portrayal about how hard your life is told by people who aren't you, which must be really fucking weird. You know, and like
because
I don't
conversation either. If we're being
it doesn't do
either,
anything.
Right? It doesn't. It
well,
doesn't.
I mean, we're years past that, right? We're just decades and decades and decades past like you know, basically opening the door up to this stuff. At this point, that's why people pushed back really hard against that show. What was the show on Amazon?
Them.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Which was
a lot of drama.
And it's like, oh, yeah, well,
just, it was also just really, it was also just really gory and really just really tough to
just watch. Yeah, and it was, and I do think people are really just kind of over it. And I, honestly, when I say people, I really mean Black people. Like, it really is just like they're just not interested in that kind of stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, not to speak on behalf of, you know, Black people, but that's my sense. And I think with queer, certainly mainstream queer cinema, that's what we have been seeing forever and ever and ever. And I think we still see it to this day.
And
I guess like a Bros here, a Fire Island there, like those, like honestly, are in my opinion huge leaps forward. Yeah. And it just like the fact,
fucking decades ago, like it's crazy that we're just, it's not
the fact that Fire Island, and I think this is a great thing. Fire Island came out and like wasn't the subject of a million fucking, you know, profiles and magazine things and everyone. It just, I think these are, you know, I think this is a good thing, but I think it is probably frustrating for you guys to talk about these movies over and over again and like have this like be like, what, I mean, what's all this shit about? I don't know. So,
like, well, that's why I think, just to not to speak for you guys, but that's why I think your podcast is so great, because I don't think your, and I truly mean that, I don't think your podcast, like what I appreciate about your podcast is the fact that you guys are watching all movies and looking at it through the lens of how queer is this, what are the queer components of this, rather than sitting down and just watching quote unquote queer movies and talking about where they rate on
fall into a deeper depression.
That was kind of my point, right? Which is that I think that the that there's a queer component to all sorts of movies, and I think that that's what we should be talking about, rather than just sort of, as Kenny said, you know, focusing on the trauma and the darkness and the, you know,
I think that's what makes this movie so interesting, is like, it does, my big takeaway is that this feels like a film that a BFA student at a college would make, specifically like Emerson, where I went to school. I'm like, this is a BFA movie. Because it's just like artsy and like, oh my god, like this love story, and we're painting each other, so you know, indie. Like you can much like feel like this, like you're in your early 20s, you're like, oh god, I have so many creative ideas, and at the same time within that you're like, but I have to like make it about my identity because I'm like struggling, and like let me throw in all these hate crimes. I feel like that's what's so weird that watching this movie, where you're like, oh, this is like a nice romance, like it's about like, can we talk to my mom about like my relationship, like how's that, and then all of a sudden it like takes that hard right turn into literally, and you're like,
white supremacy,
back up, we were good with like just the romance happy vibes, like you didn't need to throw in all the other stuff.
It's funny because it feels like, and you mentioned this earlier, Jordan, about how it's kind of just a sort of shaggy hangout movie, right? Like it's just it's a romance between these two attractive young women, and you know, one sort of dealing with her sort of the blossoming of her queerness or whatever you want to call it. And then, you know, one woman being sort of openly out. But then I would also say, too, like, the first time that they had coffee, they kiss. Like, there's just, there's no fucking, like, latency to their
relationship.
Both characters are out to begin the movie. Right, I mean, it's not really like, it's.
But Maggie's just a little less so. Maggie seems to be a little, coming is now to her family.
She performs at Game Club and works at the gay bookstore.
I mean, I'm like, not saying that her mom's like, dumb for not putting it together.
Her mom's a fucking idiot.
Her mom is a horrible character. Yeah. It's like,
although I love when she gets all the sex toys, but that's, you know, whatever.
That's a good scene.
The first thing I thought of is, you don't use someone else's vibe.
I was like, did you wash them?
Gross.
Yeah, gross.
And then on top of it,
find a random vibrator. Come on.
Just one vibrator. It's like,
it's a box of
them. 70 vibrators in this house.
And she doesn't know that they're not her daughters. Right? Like, we find out later, but when she first used them, you're like, what are we doing?
Hey.
So many questions.
Clean the vibrator.
Anyway, Yes. I think that, like, to really quickly to speak on, like, sort of the idea of of analyzing quote unquote straight movies through a queer lens. I think that, and again, if you listen to our show, I'm sorry that you have to hear us regurgitate this point that we make often, but like, we are so much more interested in connecting to the wide variety of characters that you find in like more traditionally straight movies, because so many queer movies are tied to trauma, or they're like really, really ooey gooey wholesome, which is like cute, but does like tend to lean a bit one dimensional. Yeah. And you just don't, again, it's like, you don't get to experience a ton of queer people like fighting alligators in the jungle or whatever.
Well,
you
it's, do. But so, yeah. I do think that like 2/3 of this movie are kind of just Shaggy hang out. Aren't lesbians cute? They're so in love. Isn't this great? And then, as you said, it makes a fucking hard turn in the third act to be like, go big or go home in the third act. And you're like, okay,
right. We forgot need to do that this. People are repressed and we gotta address that real
quick. I'm Joan of Arcing myself in this bookstore.
Like, the fact that this, spoilers for Better Than Chocolate, so sorry to everyone. No. But, how dare you? I know.
Everyone's seen it.
Yeah, everyone's seen it. It was my Big Fat Greek Wedding. It was everyone's favorite romantic comedy. Yeah.
The fact that this movie ends with literally like a block blowing up is
it's crazy.
Insane.
Yeah. It's like Do the Right Thing at the end in a weird, crazy way. Like it I mean, it's not. I'm not going to make a false equivalency, but you know what I mean.
No, I don't know. That's not a bad comparison.
There's similarly how there's no kind of like foreplay besides them starting to make out in a coffee shop. There's no like falling action. There's no come down. It's just like immediately credits. Here's a super quick clip show of what everyone ended up doing in the next year,
which is also unhinged,
which is crazy too. The whole like, it's like American Graffiti on like, I don't know what the fuck. Like, it's crazy how everything gets so dialed up at the end. I do want to give a synopsis, because unfortunately I don't think that many people have seen Better Than Chocolate. Not long after moving into
out there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Really Wonka. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not long after moving into her own place, Maggie finds herself with two unsolicited roommates, her recently divorced mother, Lila, I think, and her younger brother. The timing is especially bad considering Maggie has fallen hard for an attractive woman named Kim only hours before they move in. What could be a non-issue becomes increasingly complicated since Maggie's family is unaware of her sexual orientation and Maggie is not open to sharing that information. Better Than Chocolate opened on Valentine's Day, 1999. It made a little under $2 million on a $1.6 million budget, which, listen, they made a profit, whatever. It's got 46% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 78% from audiences. The New York Times said the movie gushes with so much romantic optimism and good humor that it has the effervescence of an engaging musical comedy. Sure, I don't disagree with that. I think this movie has the best of intentions. I think we all agree that this movie is progressive and has a big heart. I don't know that it really gets underneath the surface of it, though. Like, I think it's all sort of there, and I would say in 99 the surface is maybe enough, right, for people that are maybe uneducated or unaware of this, you know, culture.
Feels like a good movie for like a high schooler to watch and like to then feel like, oh, like this is the community. It's like that first sort of step, like an introductory, it's like it's literally like queer cinema 101 or whatever, you know, like where like, what is like a nice light movie that I can watch that like teaches me the issues and like gives me a little bit of the community, and like that's what this like movie's doing.
Yeah,
it's like a picture book for that a parent would give their child if they don't want to have the conversation about sex,
right? If like the kid's like 16 and is like,
a vibrator? We got you.
I heard you say lesbian once.
Yeah. I think it, like, weirdly, though, the movie tries to have its cake and eat it, too, because it is very, like, gushing and romantic, but then, like we said, it also has so many social issues. I can't believe this is reminding me of Crazy in Alabama, but do you remember how that movie is, like, half cavorting trip and half 1960s had racism? I don't know if anybody knew this.
Two different movies.
Yeah, like, so I think that it could get away with being more surface level if it didn't feel the need to shoehorn in all of, like, the very serious social issues that it needs.
I think this movie is a little more nimble than Crazy in Alabama
Agree.
In terms of dealing with issues.
I would like to say we are in your synopsis and in all this conversation, I don't know how many minutes in, it is disgusting and despicable that we have not talked about the best character in this movie. And I don't know the guy's name, but it's the one who like works next to the store. And he's like, hey, look at these lesbians. Oh my God. What am I doing here? It's You're kissing incredible. The girls.
I love his first or second scene before we don't know anything about him is like, hey, you can't kiss in the store. Right. And we're like, and what kiss. The fuck is this guy? Yes. And then by the end of the movie, we're like, Tony, is he okay?
Yeah, it's a crazy portrayal of people that are not gay.
Yes. Like,
the not gay people are basically cartoon characters.
Insane.
Which I love because insane. That's true to life.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going for on a regular basis.
That's pretty progressive TVH to just make all of your straight people the insane stereotype.
Yeah. They're all goofballs. It's really great. Really the awesome. Mom is a total goofball.
Oh my God.
There is a brother in this movie who gets a girl.
You don't remember him when they're fucking out on the outside on some weird like. It's like a small love seat or some shit like that.
Yeah, like a fuck pad. Yeah.
No. It was outside. It was like a fucking car.
A heterosexual car.
There was something.
Spot.
Hold on, because there's something. It's at the end.
There's
a butt plug. She puts the butt plug in.
Hey, she's a bisexual trying to get her new straight boyfriend to like experiment
some
fun. A little bit.
I'm not against butt plugs. I was just like a little surprised that it happened.
Phil, no, that's
actually where I draw the line. So, you know, you're making jokes
on.
Over here. Come on, this is a family podcast.
Great predatory bisexual trope in this one. Really excellent.
You should have put that on the poster. Great
predatory. Yeah.
Better than chocolate. Predatory bisexual.
I actually
will turn you gay.
She's kind of a blast, though. I love her.
Yeah. I like when they're like talking about the omnisexual at one point, and they're like, it's like the tornado in the Wizard of Oz, and I'm like, what does that mean?
Does
like, are you just
anything?
Fucking so many people you cause a storm?
Oh, you didn't know that every gay movie is legally required to have a Wizard of Oz reference?
Right.
Like,
did you know
you
say that?
You're setting the bar really high if you're saying it's like a fucking tornado, because like that person might not be able to like actually give off
live
tornado
up,
vibes.
Yeah,
you know?
Undoubtedly
are
they are
tornado
not
vibes.
It's just a tornado of penises. That's all. I think they. But
dildos?
I know, of course. So many dildos in this
so
movie.
So many dildos.
I was thinking about the Wizard of Oz because, you know, The Wizard of Oz is a real joyous movie. And I think what's interesting about your podcast, and I'll just talk about your podcast.
Yeah, sounds great.
Is
sure.
Movies that are queer coded.
Yes.
Have always been joyous. You strip the film of that need to comment on how difficult it is to be an oppressed minority in this country.
Yeah,
and you can just
and you just
have, you know, like funny allusions to sex all the time. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like a lot of fun, like a big fucking party. That's what's cool about your part.
Better
your
than
podcast.
Chocolate. A big fucking party.
A big fucking party.
No,
it's like fucking our tornado.
Better than chocolate is to me, better than chocolate for the straights. Because like that's just what it is.
it's like a little boring.
Just for the straights. Like here's a little peek, you know, take a look and you'll see some lesbian sex over here, painting, some trauma porn over there. You know, all these little things that feel like this is some stuff that us straights, you know, have heard gay people are up into and things that are happening over there in Gayville, and we'll put it all on screen. And it does feel very much like it really does. I actually don't think you should show children this movie. unlike you, Brooke.
You've done a full about face on this.
No, I have. I don't think it's a great film.
Okay, wait.
I look.
I don't.
No, I was. Just, I mean, I just
love it. To be clear, I'd give this.
We're gonna rate it. Don't you worry, guys. We're gonna rate it.
All my notes.
I think Kenny, like, other than showing a child this film, I do think you made a good point about, like, for the straights, and I think that there is an interesting subsection of queer movies that are, like, not for the straights, but that feel that they're tailored and they're made in a way that, like, are what we sort of talked about before, and, like, with this movie, where they're accessible for, like, mainstream audiences to feel comfortable watching, where it's, like, queer mm-hmm. culture, but it's so distilled in a way that feels somewhat, mm-hmm. like, heterosexual, or at least, like, there's a clear, like, one-to-one where you can feel comfortable watching it, and I feel like the first thing I thought of was, like, Happiest Season, and I feel like that's a very, like, kind of clean, mm-hmm. it's very, like, nice and wholesome, and I feel like that's sort of, like, the queer things that are, like, digestible for, like, straight audiences.
That's a great
I'm happy to talk about Happiest Season. But
you
I think it's...
To, no.
But I'm... But I think, to me, it's something a little different, and I'll make my point succinctly. There are really only three villains in this movie. One is the Canadian government, obviously a villain.
Of course. Always
has been a villain. The other is a lesbian woman who beats the shit out of Judy in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And the third are neo-Nazis. So if you're a nice straight person, you don't see yourself in this movie except represented by these, you know, silly caricatures.
The mom.
But if anything, like, I think a reasonable person sees himself in Vinny the Pizza Man or whoever, whatever his name
is. Mamma mia!
I think if anything, you see yourself in that and you're like, yeah, that's who I am. I'm the good ally who maintains my, you know, identity, but is nice to people. So I do think this really is, like, I mean, truly, like, quote unquote, for the straights. I think when you have a movie like this that doesn't actually, you know, I'll give you the other example because I was thinking of Boys Don't Cry is another example of this, because Boys Don't Cry is very much, in my opinion, for the straights. Now, it's Boys Don't Cry. The villains in that movie aren't the government. They aren't, you know, doctors. They aren't all the people that made Brandon's life miserable. They're these crazy ass fucking hicks. Yeah. These crazy ass, like, racist rapists, right? People who, like, any reasonable person would be like, I identify with Brandon and not the people raping her. Excuse me, him. I identify with them. So the idea is, like, put people on screen that doesn't comport to the audience's, a mainstream audience's version of themselves, mm-hmm. so they can start to sympathize and empathize with the queer character on screen. But I'm not slogging Boys Don't Cry at all, because I think it's a brilliant movie, and I think an early mainstream-ish trans movie kind of has to present itself that way. But I don't think this movie had to present itself this way. I think this movie's somewhat insecure in the way it's presenting itself.
I think insecure is a really good.
I think that's apt. Yeah. I think that it's. I'll say this though, because I do think that, you know, you mentioned, Jordan, that it feels like a, you know, like a film from a film student or something along those lines, and I tend to agree to a certain degree. I think that. The thing is that this movie kind of wants to just be these two women hanging out, right? Like, it kind of wants to be a Richard Linklater movie where they just chat and then they fuck and roll around in paint and then there's credits. Like, that's, I think, ultimately what the film to be.
Yes.
But then they realize, well, it has to be a movie that people go and see. So we have to inject things. And I think what you're picking up on, Kenny, and I don't disagree, is that there's a disingenuous quality to some of the plot mechanics that's going on in it, because it wants to be a big boy movie. It wants to be a movie that feels
about things,
right? And things happen and there's turns and there's things that will stay with people, because there's a fear, I think, in, you know, a lot of your talkie movies. I say that, you know, your Richard Linklater movie
and the talkies.
Which are tough, right? Because, like, it's tough to get people to fully engage in those movies. You know, Kenny and I have talked on many occasions about the Before movies and how it's a miracle to watch those films because they're just so fucking compelling.
Yeah,
but, like, that's like, it's like a, it's a, it's, so few of them can pull that off.
Exactly.
And it's when you, it's yeah. because you have Richard Linklater and those actors and that dialogue. Right. And then you right. see, it's like with people who like want to do Malick, and then you see the knockoff Malicks and you're like,
don't
Terrence Malick does Terrence Malick because he's him. Yeah. Yeah. You shouldn't be touching this. And I think it's like knowing, not to be like stick in your lane, but like,
yeah,
it's about like as a creative, like trying to like stay authentic to yourself. And I think like not trying to crib from something. And I think that if this movie, I don't know much about like what happens later on in this person's career, et cetera. But like, I think not ultimately, it, no, not really. But
as with the case with most Canadian filmmakers, yeah. unfortunately.
Oh, the syrup got to them. Oh no.
Oh my yeah, God.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Too much poutine.
The syrup got to them.
Like they're stuck, you know, they can't
move. Yeah,
the career syrup. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yes. The career of.
But no, I think it is about though, like, this movie is trying to throw in so much just because the insecurity of it. And I feel like that's where the third act, where you really start to feel it, because sure. it is like, we have to wrap up our movie. We should leave people with like a theme or like a statement and like, what's going to be like, what are you walking out with? And I think you can even see it sometimes in a little bit of cinematography where there's like, they try to do like the 90s tricks. Like when they like fast forward the footage. So they're like walking super fast around the store. And you're like, this feels so out of place within the context of what was happening. Like, 5 minutes ago, like it doesn't feel genuine at times to it, you know.
Do the right thing is, you know, it's a somewhat apt comparison to me. We did it in our 89 pod, and I think it's like, you know, the best movie.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We have the fucking 20th century.
It's a fucking masterpiece.
And part of it is because it dares to make the villain so fucking relatable.
Yeah,
like it dares to make Danny Aiello so relatable that people walk out of that movie and struggle with what happened at the end of that film. They really struggle, and you really have to grapple with, as a white person, you really have to grapple with who you are in that film, because you're not John Turturro. I get that, right? You're not the guy who's like being an open racist, but like, you're probably Danny Aiello in that movie. And that's like, you really have to just struggle with like, are you doing enough? Are you taking other people's culture? Are you taking other people's property? Are you encroaching where you shouldn't be encroaching? Should you be, how do you have all these things? And you, when you think about villains in these kind of big theme movies, I think about a movie I really like called The Contender. I'm sure you all saw it. Joan Allen.
Yeah.
The villain of that movie is Gary Oldman, mustache twirly fucking Republican senator.
Fucking asshole.
Who doesn't look like any of us, right? Yeah. He's the easiest guy in the world to villainize. Like the bold move is to take someone who looks like they're an ally and they're actually not.
Yeah.
And
it's like the
really
internalized homophobia, and like where it's like the villain is like, you're looking at something and you're like, oh, this person's so deeply related. And there's that one turn or that one small thing where you're like, oh, that you're like, you don't like this person because of X, Y, or Z. And I feel like, speaking of like Fire Island, I think does like it in a pretty decent way, where you're like looking at like the internalized racism and like body shaming and like within the confines of like the queer community and how certain subsects and people like view and judge other people even within a community. And I feel like I completely agree with what you're saying, is like, this movie would be so much stronger if instead of it was a fucking Nazi, it was like, when you have that lesbian attack, I think in the bar, I think that is interesting. I think there's a kernel there where it's talking about like the infighting within the queer community and sort of that transphobia. And I think that is an interesting facet that the movie digs into. And so you sort of wish that
I agree with that.
the overarching villain, or at least like the themes within, like, what are the conflicts within the community at some point. But that's not what the movie has on its mind at all.
And it also doesn't really lay a ton of piping in terms of where these white supremacists, Nazis, what have you. They really just kind of come out of nowhere.
They're monsters.
I just mean if we had the sense that
I'm saying the same thing.
Yeah.
The same thing for the Judy storyline too. Like, you know, it's like there's not, I think like the movie is so refreshing because up until that point, it's extremely like non-transphobic in terms of how people are talking to her. And like, she has this like incredibly supportive community, and like, she's doing good in people's lives. And is like a super important part of the core ensemble. And then it's just, again, there's not really a lot of groundwork laid, but I think that like, you know, the reason that something like Do the Right Thing is in such a league of its own is because that balance of being like, you want to introduce a relatable villain who does in a way inflict trauma on your more marginalized like main characters, but everything, you feel like the movie strikes an incredible and really important balance by the end. It's so difficult to do because it's the same thing. You have, you know, with the bathroom scene with Judy, you have a villain who maybe some viewers can relate to, but the balance is not there. Like, it's too much, too fast, too quick. Like, no one is going to be like, oh shit, maybe that's me, because it's so intense. So it's,
I mean, part of it is also in the specificity, right? Like, I'll just say this, it's unfair for us to compare Better Than Chocolate to
I
Do
would
the
agree.
Right Thing.
Yes.
But I'll continue the metaphor because I do think that there's something there. Yeah. I do think that, I mean, Do the Right Thing, the sheer amount of unbelievably specific characters, the bench of characters that exists in that film is insane, right? Like, you feel like you know that corner of the world so unbelievably well. This film similarly is you know, about a corner or a neighborhood, and yet the specificity of everyone outside of basically three or four characters, they just kind of, they bleed into the woodwork. It is unfortunate. I do want to just a couple pieces of context that I think are worth giving here. So the plotline about the bookstore is a fairly direct reference to a Vancouver bookstore, Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, and the various problems that it had with the Canadian customs. The bookstore is thanked in the credits. The bookstore owner is a fairly well-known Canadian author, Anne-Marie MacDonald, who has written several quite successful Canadian books, or books, period. They're not Canadian. They're just books. But I do think that I didn't know she could act. And in fact, this is the only time she's ever acted. I believe she might've been a producer as well on the film, if I'm not mistaken. She was quite good. I thought she was actually surprisingly. I mean, I would argue that the relationship between her and Judy and the bookstore owner's name, forgive me, I don't know what the owner's name is off the top of my head, is a more interesting relationship than the one between our two leads, because the one between our two leads is just wide-eyed, you know, horny lesbians. Like, they're just, which is great. I mean, no, I'm not dogging it, but I do think that there isn't a ton of obstacles there other than the fact that it feels as though Kim is a little bit more experienced and is a little bit sort of, quite frankly, annoyed with Maggie's lack of experience at times. Whereas the Judy relationship is a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting.
Yeah. And I think like massive props to the film for having a relationship between, you know, a cis lesbian and a trans woman where the issue that's like keeping them apart has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that Judy is trans and is more about just like, I don't know if I'm ready for a relationship. Like, it's wonderful. And I think that like, it's definitely more interesting just because it has like ups and downs, and it feels like it has like authenticity to it in the way that the young.
And again, it comes back to sort of, you know, the specificity of it. It doesn't feel like something we've seen before. I gotta ask you guys what you think about the brother watching his sister have sex with another woman?
Not great.
Two thumbs down.
Weird. I also think it's
bizarre.
I also just think it's really funny that the woman who he ends up with, the aforementioned slightly aggressive bisexual woman who also works at the bookstore, is like so invested in her name Maggie, the main character? I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Maggie's the main character.
Like, so interested in trying to kind of like get Maggie, and then the second that her brother walks in is like, oh, never mind.
I want that guy. I'm trying to think of the, just, I'm looking at the cast names. The brother is Paul.
What's his name? Paul. I kind of feel
Francis is the bookstore owner.
The bookstore owner. Paul gets a little shafted, literally and figuratively. Maybe.
Nice. Yeah, he gets a,
Because, like, they just don't, he has nothing to contribute, really. No.
Negative
things to contribute. I think that the scene
he contributes being creepy and watching his sister have sex.
I mean, assume that scene is meant to raise the stakes with, like, oh no, is he accidentally or purposefully gonna out his sister?
But then, like, it doesn't
go there. But I also wonder if it's about him. I think it's twofold. I think it's what you just said in terms of just the stakes of the plotting. But then I also wonder, is it about him, you know, expanding his mind in terms of what is.
We'll never know, because he only has like two lines in the entire movie.
Yeah, he disappears and then he gets a butt plug in the end. It's not a lot. He doesn't have a lot to bring to the... I do think... I want to talk for a second about the soundtrack, which is so 90s and so much like hippie folk lesbian emo rock. It's amazing.
I really loved the opening number.
Same.
Like, I felt like... I watched it twice. I thought it was like electric.
It has some real life to it, and like the performance sequences are kind of like low-key the best thing in the movie.
God, yeah. I mean, Judy's song is fantastic.
Excellent.
I totally agree. It's like there is this weird like cabaret element to it.
Yes,
you know, come back to this club and let them do the whole performances, and you know, they talk to the movie, or at least they're supposed to. But I thought that was definitely the best part of.
I also appreciate that they throw you in
aspect.
They throw you right in the deep end, right? You don't get your title credits for, I think it's until 5 or 10 minutes into the film, after the sequence that Kenny was speaking of, which I kind of love. I love a movie that doesn't give you the title right away, that kind of is like, you know, sink or swim a little bit. The Blacklight
is musical sequence. Is this a movie I was supposed to see?
Yeah. There's the Blacklight musical sequence as well, which is bizarre, but kind of great. I have to agree that the music stuff is a real shot in the arm. Like, when that's happening, you're at least kind of like, okay, you have my attention. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I actually think that this movie would have been basically a slam dunk if it was like maybe one or two more musical numbers, and then, like we said, Linklater movie. Like, give us the two queer female driven storylines, like, and a bunch of musical numbers. And like, this is
The thing about Cabaret also uses Nazis really effectively. So
much more effectively. Yeah.
Very much so. If they could find their Nazi moment just like that, that'd be, but that's, I mean, I don't want to get into Cabaret, but that's, you know,
it's a better movie.
That's the whole,
it's a much better movie.
It is a better movie, but there is the beauty of that scene.
It's the same shit. Like we were saying, it's the same sort of like trauma driven thing that like makes the social aspects of Better Than Chocolate like a little bit of a bummer, is that it's like, it is really ingrained in a lot of the queer community. Like, I think especially the like lesbian focused bookstore is so funny to me, where they're like at Canadian Customs being like, why is it like 500 ways to use the clit allowed into the country? It's I love it so much. And I think that like, there's clearly parts of this movie that are made very much for the queer community, which makes when they're like, guys, did we all forget that neo-Nazis hate gay people? It's like, no,
we
not
remember.
Really. We remember.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when she...
My favorite scene. Little Red Riding Hood should be allowed in the country. Like, what is going on? I love bureaucratic anger, especially when it's from, you know, like a 5'2 lesbian.
I'll say this: when she paints herself and she put in the window, right?
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
I really thought, okay, because forgive me if I imagine this, but is it not on the news? I think it's on the news, right?
They're going to go. They're going to go get the press. I don't know if it ever comes to fruition because the building blows up. But that is where Frances goes, and that's why she's like, not there.
Yeah. My just off camera, there was a person who came with the big press thing on her hat. So
yeah. And like a tiny
Tony on his ear,
McAllister ear down at the local lesbian bookstore.
I bring this up because I feel like the movie in my mind was going to end with it's on the news, it becomes a whole thing, there's a protest or something like that, and then we get credits. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's where it should have gone, right? I mean, yes. I understand the fact that they wanted to show that there are people that are not for this lesbian bookstore, fine, so be it. But they went to 11 when they really just needed to go to 6 or 7. Yeah. Because what it also does is the Chirons at the end are like this kind of happy-go-lucky kind of goofy shit.
Yeah.
It's just like, wait, we just had Nazis, guys.
Right. Yeah,
like, you can't go, you just went too far with Nazis. It should have just been, you know, some fucking, I don't know, some right-wing parents protesting the bookstore or some
people
shit like
almost
that.
Died. PTA I also, or something. I think exactly. I think that the bureaucratic element is like almost the most interesting aspect of like we were talking about the kind of like insidious, like under the radar homophobia, where it's like we don't consider these books appropriate.
Right?
Why not? Like it's sort of digging into that and like the back and forth that goes on there is much more interesting. Definitely. I think. Just much more fitting for like the scale of this movie.
Well, that's and also just the tone of it. Like it just would have flattened it out a little bit in the sense of it feeling a little bit more of a piece. Because I just think that they just, again, not to belabor the point, but had they not gone as far, I think that it all just would have felt a little smoother. And I would have been okay with kind of cross-cutting between Maggie's mom using what she thinks potentially are Maggie's sex toys, cross-cutting with the brother getting railed with a butt plug, and then the Nazis. You can't have these things.
One of these
together.
Things is not
one
like
of these
the
things
other.
Does not belong.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, it's just it's too much.
It's too much.
So yeah,
I think about this film premiering at TIFF, and I cannot imagine what it was like just sitting in the theater being like, what a nice little oh my god.
What the fuck. Well, I wonder what the Cannes like standing ovation versus boo ratio would be if it was at Cannes instead.
As if this movie would ever.
But I gotta say, for what it's worth, the film screened at festivals around the world. It ranked 31st on the Hollywood Reporter's top 200 independent films of 1999. I'm not sure there are 200 independent films.
Wait. Can we get that list?
I gotta find that list.
I was gonna say, y'all might need it.
Is that like counting like high school movies?
Is
like
there? What we're talking about here? Can you think of 200 independent movies from 99, Kenny?
Not off the top of my head, but you know,
I just didn't think there were that many. I mean,
if it's 31, that interests me because in 99, we were talking, you know, Searchlight movies
some
for
fucking
independent.
Bangers,
Miramax were independent.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're talking probably 60-70% of the movies we've done.
Yeah, I think that seems a little crazy, but who knows?
Even indie films, you know. I mean, foreign films were all kind of considered indie movies at that point. Mm-hmm. Docs, there's so many great docs. I think if you want to do it, I'll do it. So, Being John Malkovich was an indie movie.
I'm gonna see if I can find
Magnolia. I'm kidding, but
you have 198 more to go.
I think I could name 200 if I had to. Better Than Chocolate.
This is also I feel like you guys cover this. This is the same year also as But I'm a Cheerleader, which I feel is that same sort of like I think a much better
balance movie
between like for the community and also something that is kind of very interesting to watch as like an outsider and so satirical, but also really has something to say.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that movie's clicking on a bunch more levels. It's also attempting to do something that I would argue is more difficult, and thus the success. If you are successful at doing those things, you're immediately going to seem like. I mean, this movie. And again, I know that we're kind of picking it apart. I think that it's not striving.
What are you gonna do?
No. And that's fine. I don't think that it's striving for much more than showing people that perhaps don't have positive perspectives on homosexuality or the gay culture, that like, there's nothing to be afraid of here. This is just, they're just, you know, they're beautiful lesbian women that love each other. Who cares? Like there does seem to be that component to it. And because its goals are so modest, it makes the film feel modest because they're just, I mean, I, as I said earlier, I think that the Francis and Judy relationship is striving for more. Mm-hmm. I think that that relationship is trying to sort of shine a light on something that, quite frankly, isn't even particularly being well done now, let alone in 1999. I mean, I think that I love at the end of Judy's song when she says, "I'm not a fucking drag queen." Like, I think that, like, that is bold, sharp rhetoric of you know, a group of people that are just not getting spoken about. Yeah. You know, yes, Boys Don't Cry does an infinitely better job at unpacking those issues in a much more complex and much more, you know, harrowing journey that movie has.
They're aiming for two very, completely very different things.
Judy's so comfortable with like who she is, and I think like as some, kind of we were talking about was sort of like where the trans conversation was at this point in 1999. I mean, you even see it in the casting. Like, Judy is played by a cis male actor, Peter Outerbridge, but I will say I think it's a very good performance. Obviously, like, you know, should definitely have been played by a trans actor, but again, like we said,
right, for the time, right.
Like, it's not, we're not, again, not like picking it apart by like 2022 standards, but I was very impressed with the performance. It
didn't feel like
not at all. It's a really a wonderful performance.
It could have been like stereotypical and like a way where you're like, this is like really uncomfortable to watch, and it's not.
But in talking about, you know, cis actors playing trans roles, which clearly did not stop in the year 2000, like this is like miles ahead of so many portrayals that we saw in later years and on much bigger stages.
I think that God, this is probably way out of my depth, but
we got you. We'll help you.
Thank you, guys. I only think one of the three actors in Two Wong Fu comes close to handling this correctly. I don't want to say yet, but the other two, I feel like, are constantly protecting their masculinity. And I don't feel like Peter Outerbridge is. The one is, I'll tell you, it's John Leguizamo. I think he just,
I was gonna say, fucking, is he in Moulin Rouge?
I think he fucking murders it in that movie, and I think he's like a revelation. Good. But I felt the whole movie, like Patrick Swayze and Wesley Snipes were just protecting themselves, and there was always a wink of, you know, I'm playing a character, this isn't really me. Leguizamo really kind of completely owns that role.
Well, I would say to that point too, if you look at Priscilla, which, I mean, Tu Wong Fu is ultimately a ripoff of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, in some ways. Those three, I think, are, well, Priscilla was you know, a big sleeper hit,
and it was certainly first, but
My point, different more than anything, is just the three performances in Priscilla: Hugo Weaving, Guy Pearce, and Terrence Stamp. Right, like there is no. I don't believe that any of them are protecting their masculinity at all in that film.
That does feel like very similar to the beginning of the conversation, the difference between Australia and America. And particularly, you know, what's that?
No, I agree. I mean, I just think we've sort of discussed this before, but like, Australians just go fucking hog wild no matter what.
They go hard, man.
They're fucking crazy down under.
They're the greatest and best people in the world.
I love
them. Fucking love those guys. I think he did a really good job. The thing about this movie, and I don't want to be too hard on it, because all right, so the director's name is Ann Wheeler. I don't know if we've mentioned that. The writer's name is Peggy Thompson. My sense is they wanted to make a movie about their friends. Like, it's just, that's how it feels. Like, they just wanted to make a movie about their friends. Like, they're obviously filmmakers, not sitting out, but it's the kind of thing where they're sitting around and saying, I think we're a movie. Like, I think we're a movie. And, you know, and I think in their circle, they had people like Francis, and they had people like Judy, and they had people like Tony, and they had that kind of thing. And exactly. And I think the people they didn't really have in their circle are the mom character and the brother character, who feel like, you know, they're flown in from the set of Leave It to Beaver or something.
Yeah, literally.
So I
tell their, and, you know, the end.
And I do think, and I do think, sorry, Brooke, the last thing is, I do think that the more kind of
know, over the top elements that rub us all the wrong way do feel like it might, they might just be kind of like grasps at relevancy, right? Like it is, as I said, Insecure. It's very hard to just make a movie about you and your friends, because like I was talking to someone today about yesterday about a movie I don't like at all, but some people like, about Kicking and Screaming, which is just a movie about, you know, your friends.
The Noah Baumbach movie.
Yes, and I think
the Will Ferrell one.
The Will Ferrell movie, you know,
I was just soccer being clear, George.
I think that, you know, a movie like Kicking and Screaming to me is also a, like, let's just make a movie about us, right? Yes. Let's make a movie about us. And I know a lot of people really, you know, ride for it. And it just, for me, it's like super boring. And I think a lot of these films are super boring. Yep. And if you don't put something in there that, you know, is kind of thematically elevated, you feel a little vulnerable. Right. And I think that's what it is.
I think it's like you are saying this in my brain. It's just like flashing lights saying like Kevin Smith, because it feels like that feels like all of his, like, especially like the early movies for him. It's just like, what if I got a camera and I made some movies with my friends and we swore a lot? And like, that feels like the queer version of, like, this is like the queer version of that with like an explosion and a neo-Nazi added in.
But
do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. I think that all I was going to say...
If it was
say,
more hangouty.
Right. All I was going to say earlier is that I really like the sort of sense of wish fulfillment. I don't know if it's like strictly like, you know, the director and the writer's wish fulfillment, but queer wish fulfillment at the end of the movie where your potentially homophobic family is actually totally cool with everything and really just wants you to be happy and supported. And I think that like this movie is so incredibly well-intentioned and that it really just like... there is absolutely nothing but like the best of like feelings behind this movie. And I think you can really feel like the sincerity and the earnestness, which some people I think tend to knock cinema for, that like feels like too earnest. You're like, you put core. Too much.
I mean,
of
Kenny
your
and I
soul.
Love a sincere movie. We have no problem.
This guy.
Oh my God, it's everything.
Not this guy. The sincerity is the highest form of art. To have the guts to put it out there raw.
Yeah,
but I'll say this, you know? And I agree with you guys. I love a sincere movie as well, and I think this movie is sincere. But I also think that this movie wants to be a little audacious. It wants to be a little bit sort of like shocking is the wrong word, but just
After
sort of being like
special.
Yeah, just well, no, After School specials aren't audacious. I think that this movie's trying to kind of be. A little cool, a little shocking at times. I think it's certainly more shocking in terms of its sort of playfulness about sexuality, right? I mean, the sex toy stuff, the butt plug stuff, the sex component of this movie is quite playful and quite sort of a little in your face at times. And I think that again, doesn't totally jive with the sincerity and the open-heartedness and the hard on your sleeveness of the movie. They're kind of bumping up against each other, unfortunately.
Can I like weirdly disagree?
Oh.
Sure.
You could just disagree.
You've done
it
now, Phil.
She's burning the fucking books.
I think that I mostly because this is like, I think like a common sort of like issue that gets brought up in queer cinema is like, can it be sexy if it's too sexy? Are we saying that like everything queer is like related to sex, but if it's not sexy, are we saying that that's not a part of the thing? Because that tends to be like a lot of people's who are slightly homophobics like hang up with like queerness in general is like the sex part. So I think that it's nice to kind of see a sincere movie that's also very sex forward. I completely agree that like there's a little
I think it's doing both. I don't think what you and I are saying are mutually exclusive is the point I'm trying to make. I think that, you know, Kenny mentioned this earlier of like, we want to make a movie about us and we want to make a movie about like the shit that we do and just kind of, you know, whatever. And I think that someone in that conversation is going to be like, yeah, but can the streets fucking handle it?
Right.
And I think that that's kind of infused in this too, of a little bit of like, we're going to give you a little bit of just how, you know, sexy and what I think that there's something, there's mixed messages going on in this film in terms of its tone, in terms of, I don't necessarily think about what it wants to say, because I think what it wants to say is pretty much on its face. But I do think that in terms of how successful they wanted this film to be, what they were sort of hoping, what vein they were hoping to hit with it, is anyone's guess. I do think, you know, that this movie was a pretty big deal in Canada. I mean, it actually did quite well. It played at a bunch of festivals. It was, you know, named after a fucking Sarah McLachlan song.
We have to say
a good Sarah McLachlan song. I love that in the Wikipedia plot synopsis, they say the clandestine romance introduces Maggie's family to a host of new experiences, many of which are quote unquote better than chocolate, which I think is ridiculous.
Some than chocolate.
Old chocolate that's been out for a while. It's a little right. dusty.
There's also something amazing about the fact that over the at the very end of the movie, they obviously play the Sarah McLachlan song Ice Cream, right? But rather than waiting to the verse where she says your love is better than chocolate, they jump ahead. So it's literally like we're thrown into the middle of the song so that yes. we hear that line first. That,
yep.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, whatever. It is what it is. I don't know. I think that there are far better movies about gay culture. I think there are far better movies in 1999 about gay culture what? Than this film. But I also think that this movie deserves, you know, a little bit of a tip of the hat to doing what it was doing yes. when it was doing it.
Yeah.
There is a fearlessness to it, despite the fact that maybe it doesn't stick the landing entirely. I think it has some nice things to say. I don't know. I mean, in terms of the films that we've covered thus far in 99, Kenny, but I'm a cheerleader feels like the one that Brooke brought up feels like the, maybe the most overt one that comes to mind.
Just about gayness?
Gay movies. I mean, Talented Mr. Ripley, obviously.
Talented
Mr. Ripley is always. Obviously
the perfect movie.
Fucking yeah. best.
I'm trying to think of other
but
ones.
I'm a cheerleader as well. I mean, there's some that, you know, have
you look this up.
The are Matrix
kind of,
right yeah,
I was going to say, the Matrix in particular is certainly that. And
I mean,
Being John Malkovich is also a pretty gay movie. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, definitely dealing with, yes.
Yeah.
A lot of, yeah. American Beauty,
but also, I don't want to talk about the movie. Yuck.
The second time we brought that up today, Kenny.
Yucko.
Yeah, yucko.
Beau Travail is apparent. We've not covered that one yet, but that's good.
We will get there.
All About My Mother is 99.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Big time. We did that. Yeah. That, obviously.
I mean, Cruel Intentions kind of.
Oh, hell yes, it does.
Well.
We've talked about it.
Well. How could you not?
I mean, Fight Club deals with it.
Fight Club, hella gay.
One of the gayest movies ever made.
Yeah. What if I could be gay for myself?
But this is
yeah.
This is where sort of like the gay culture versus straight culture, mainstream versus indie conversation is really because it's like, you know, if I search 1999 gay movies, the Fight Club and The Matrix do not come up. However, Better Than Chocolate.
Well, but I think that's kind of what I was talking about with Wizard of Oz. Like, those movies are some of the gayest movies I've ever made. And they're also not about trauma. They're about, you know, kung fu.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
It's just,
The Wizard of Oz specifically.
I do want to just, also, because I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't at least just list some of the other ones from 99. Flawless was a big film dealing with, obviously, gay culture.
Flawless.
Happy Texas is another one.
I guess we've done a lot.
There are a fair amount of them in 99. But yes, this is probably in the middle, I would say, in terms of a middling entry in the LGBTQ plus canon of 1999. Kenny, would you like to rate this film?
Sure.
I'm going to let you go first on this one, Kenny.
Yeah,
would you say it is better or worse than chocolate?
Chocolate, well.
That's the rating for this film.
Definitely better than milk chocolate, which sucks. Worse than dark chocolate, which is good. And white chocolate, which is very good.
White chocolate is disgusting. I don't know how you eat white chocolate.
White chocolate
Kenny,
is horrible.
I will say, I like baking with white chocolate. But
white chocolate's amazing.
Raw dogging white chocolate is a little unhinged.
Can I just say that we have devolved into rating chocolates right now?
Wait a second.
I mean, look.
Let me start. Relax. Hold on. Gotta get into this. Okay. I know that my white chocolate obsession, which is probably my favorite food, is highly controversial.
It's not as bad as being like mayonnaise is my favorite spice, but it's up there.
That's very gross. And I know that dark chocolate is the people's chocolate these days, and it is because it's chocolate fantastic.
It's great,
but it's the people's chocolate. But milk chocolate, in particular, Hershey's chocolate, tastes like vomit.
Yes,
and I don't know how anybody. It is true, Phil, and actually. It's actually scientific.
You also think that cheese is disgusting.
You don't like cheese?
Well, cheese is literally disgusting. It's a mold, but that's not the point. I'm gonna get back.
This is so good. What is happening here?
I'm gonna read something to you.
Is it the definition of fucking cheese?
All right.
Kenny, I don't mean to throw
What is You just did, but it's okay.
What is cheese?
What's not subjective, ladies and gentlemen, is the fact that butyric acid is found in milk, which is in Hershey's chocolate, and that butyric acid can create notes of sourness and tang, which, yes, some sensitive tasters or those used to European chocolate, like myself, could feel is reminiscent of vomit.
Kenny has a fancy palate, guys.
Where butyric acid also hangs out. So butyric acid is something that is in milk chocolate and also vomit. That's why milk chocolate. Actually, I've been wondering for years why I can't eat milk chocolate because it's truly the most disgusting food there is.
I think that it's made with vomit. By the way, I genuinely didn't mean to throw Kenny under the bus on the cheese.
Oh, don't worry. Fuck cheese.
I do want to just say this, which is that I do think that it is
I hate vomit. I hate eating vomit.
There's a known, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, there are people that are sensitive to certain tastes and certain smells that do trigger things for them. Get where Kenny's coming from. But on a purely just taste level, white chocolate's fucking gross. So yeah, that's just
weird to me.
Do you guys not white chocolate and cranberry like cookie?
No, we're
like
just
that?
Talking about like strictly. Also, doesn't white chocolate have
what are you why are like you looking at me like I'm a fucking idiot? Have you not had it?
That's how Kenny looks at everybody though. He's looking up something. I think
That's my face. And that's actually one of my worst traits is
when you're in the room, people can tell that you don't like.
Yes, a friend of mine. It's not people can tell, dude. It's like my friend, Manny Figueroa, who's been on the podcast many times. Is a good friend of mine. It took like we were right on a show together, and it took him like 3 months, and he's just like, you know, a lot of the girls like think like you think they're stupid, but like I keep trying to tell them like that's just your face. He's like this is just you have like resting asshole face, and I'm like that's unfortunate for me.
No,
I don't think you have a resting asshole face, but I'll just say this because I you know, we've been in many rooms together, and some people do have a resting sort of like they're you know, they're furrow their brows when they're thinking. And as you know, when you're pitching in a room, it's very performative and it can be a little nerve wracking. So when someone's like got this like crinkled brow, you're just like, what, you don't like it? You don't like what I'm pitching? It can get into your head. I think
I have this like,
ever since I started doing Zooms in general, and I always have the little box with my face, the hide self view is for some people, not for me. I have to do this like kind of performative, like tiny little like half smile because I look extremely, I have resting bitch face.
I
don't think so.
You've never seen me not on a Zoom.
We haven't seen it? We haven't seen it? Okay.
Guys, I thought Brooke hated me for 17 years. Yeah.
That's a resting, really? That's a fucking mean face.
That is my like actual.
Wait, let me see your resting face.
This is so great for the audience. Let me see your resting face. Patreon.
Yeah, the Patreon.
Like, if I do nothing.
I guess. You know, when I was in mental health treatment for being crazy, one of the things you learn when you're there is something that really helps you.
Yeah.
Is a Mona Lisa smile.
Yeah.
That just in general, it makes you feel better. Just a little Mona Lisa smile all the time or as often as you can actually is that and you know, hands open. So I try to do that, but I feel like the Joker.
you look a little uncomfortable. Anyway.
What's your rating on this film, Kenny?
How it's many like, things of white chocolate?
72 white chocolate snow caps.
Okay.
Before... I'm gonna go down to like 65. I think that's where this movie lives for me. It's hard to hate something with such good intentions. It's hard to hate something that seems like, you know, nice people trying to make a nice movie about other nice people. And I didn't hate it. I actually think there are moments that are really inspired. So and I think we did talk a lot about the leads, but I thought the girl who played Maggie was really winning. And I like that. I like the aesthetic. I think it's a great movie. I mean, a good movie. It's a 65.
Brooke?
I am actually totally aligned with Kenny. I think 65 is the perfect rating for how I feel about this. About 65% of this movie, I'm very on board with. And the remaining 35%? I can't do math. I am really not. But again, I do think that, like, it is very winning a lot of the time, and I think a very sweet movie, aptly named, for the most part. So I'll stick with the 65. Oh, don't boo me. You've done worse.
No, I have.
All right, Jordan, your turn.
I guess my first question is, I've been thinking about this the whole podcast, is like, I feel like the bookstore owner would be pretty upset about how willy-nilly they are about like using their books for like art. Like when she puts all the books in like the ice thing and they're burning books, it just felt like a lot of money being burned on books.
I agree.
That's been like weighing on me for this podcast. And I just needed to say it.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I'm subtracting the books from my final score. I don't know. I think I didn't like it as much as other people. Maybe that's just because I was bumping on some of the other stuff in the tonal whiplash to the neo-Nazis at the end, really. It kind of
judge you.
It doesn't leave you with as warm of a taste as you start with the chocolate. Like, you know, like you get that first bite of chocolate and it's really good, but then you eat the whole bar in one sitting and you're kind of like, you don't feel as good as you did when you started. And that's kind of this movie.
I can't believe you booed me for just saying that.
Yeah, seriously. Your metaphor got
something sweet. Jesus. Anyway.
I think it's a pretty apt comparison. I'm just saying. So I'm going to go with 55.
You can't eat too much white chocolate.
55.
That's not that mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
You are oversold it.
Well, okay. So
that's pretty mean.
I came into this podcast at a 70. I'm going to hold it a 70. The Canadian in me is.
I was going to make a joke, and it's real. I was going to say that's the Canadian surtax, but
yeah, there's a little bit of the Canadian surtax. I mean, ultimately, I think that, and you mentioned it earlier, Kenny, that we really didn't talk that much about the leads. Karen Dwyer, who is really, really lovely in this film, and is no longer with us, unfortunately, is really, really charming, really winning, watchable. I'm surprised that she didn't have a bigger career coming off of this film, quite frankly. And I think that she just made a lot of it kind of palatable for me in a weird way. That, not to say that Kim was bad, that Christina Cox, who plays Kim, was bad. I felt like she was a little bit more one note. I felt like Maggie had a bunch of different things she had to do. I just think ultimately, you said it best, Kenny, like, best of intentions. I think this movie is a sweet, good-hearted movie that's trying to sort of just, you know, be a nice film about, you know, how gay people are really nice and horny. And that's, you know, what's wrong with that, right? So that's where I fall on this. More than anything, we'd like to thank you for coming on to talk about Better Than Chocolate with us. And I actually, while we have you, the episode's over, but there is a movie that Kenny and I, that I forgot about, that Kenny brought to my attention, that I watched the trailer for the other night, called Body Shots, that is a 99 film that You've seen this film? Have you seen Body Shots?
No, but it was a real film.
It was a real film. The trailer for this movie, can you just bring it up on YouTube and read aloud the quote at the beginning of the movie, of the trailer? Because I don't know if Kenny's seen it.
Can we just talk about... Oh, sorry. Are you pulling the trailer up?
No, I'm not. But you want to pull the trailer?
I'm on the letterbox, and I was sorry. I was just reading the...
I was reading the slug line. Yeah.
Where tonight it's for sex. Tomorrow it's for real. And then just like I looked at the cast.
I'll just say this. The trailer...
I got it.
Are you watching the trailer? It literally goes
The 60s The Graduate. 70s Saturday Night Fever. 80s Breakfast Club.
Body Shots is what they think is the, on par with these movies?
This is a film.
The movies that defined the decade. The Graduate in the 60s, Saturday Night Fever in the 70s, Breakfast Club in the 80s, and Body Shots in the 90s. So here's the question. What's the right answer?
This is a movie about how a group of friends is torn apart after one accuses another of rape.
Correct. Correct.
Oh, I can't wait to watch this movie.
Yeah. That sounds like
that's
so
why
much
I'm
fun.
The reason I bring this up is, I think Brooke and Jordan need to come on for Body Shots. I think that they would be perfect guests.
We would love to have
this.
This
is the most upsetting trailer I've seen in my life, and I have no sound on.
I know you all are funny people, but I'm gonna ask you to be sincere because it's the highest form of art right now.
So not the Judd Apatow movie?
I'm listening.
Buddy people, I get it. I need to watch a movie with my daughter starting now. She's 10 years old. She likes YA shit. She just binged all Stranger Things. She is on a kind of horror kick, but like we're not going too horror. She wanted me to pick the movie. What do you got? I haven't picked yet. That's what I'm asking. I want your help.
Like introductory horror.
Her favorite movie is Happy Death Day, to give you a sense of like,
oh, what she's about, like, already Poltergeist. She's like in.
Have you seen, have you watched Freaky yet?
Yeah, I love Freaky.
Have you shown her Fear Street yet?
Oh, Fear Street's interesting.
Is Fear Street too much?
Fear Street's kind of brutal. A little with the head through the thing.
Yeah.
Like, I would not show my kid that.
All right. Well,
Poltergeist is pretty mild, though, right?
I can't do Poltergeist. I think Poltergeist
like
actually
for, like,
will kind of mess her up.
Fun, scary. Fun. I don't know. I don't want to recommend Scream. I feel like that's too much.
I mean, I watched it with my son. Who watches everything. We just binge Breaking Bad. Who's the same age? It's a 10-year-old.
Oh, my God.
I'm just a great dad.
This is what I wanted growing up. I was doing this on my own.
Freaky's not a bad idea, actually.
Freaky,
but I don't want to watch the movie I've seen. Would you want to watch it?
It's like
my fucking dark, movie. Dude. You're going to show her
for,
it?
Like, fun.
Well, we're all
I'm looking at fun. Evil Dead 2? That's like a blast.
You need to watch the first Evil Dead.
Drag Me to Hell.
Oh my god!
I really think we can watch Evil Dead 2?
Evil Dead 2 is like not bad at all. It's like a cartoon.
Same with Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
No, Drag Me to Hell. I think she really likes really, really cute girls in the lead.
Okay.
Like the girl in
Happy
Drag Me
Death
to Hell.
Day. Yeah,
sorry, Drag Me. Not that the girl in Happy Death.
What
Day
about
isn't
like a binge,
escape room?
Drag Me to Hell isn't cute.
Or like a Final Destination.
Maybe Final Destination.
That movie, that's like a traumatizing thing though. Like, I was scared of cars with logs for like 30 years.
Okay,
and escalators.
Irony of the whole thing is like she's a genuinely terrified person, scared of everything. But all the great horror movie fans generally are.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it. It's like immersion therapy.
Absolutely.
So, but she's scared of everything. Now
let me know what you pick. I'm curious. All right, guys.
Too.
Body Shots is coming up. Let you
too. Maybe we'll do
Body
Evil
Shots.
Evil Dead's a good one.
Evil Dead. My final recommendation is Zombieland. A cute girl in the lead.
She knows too.
And
she loves that. Loves La La Land.
And we need to do it on our podcast so you can take notes. There you go.
All right.
It's a 2009 movie. All right. All right. Bye, guys.
I like
that. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.